Hello, and welcome to the reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette for today. It's Thursday, August 11. I'm your reader, Kathleen. Our front page story is UI needs state okay for cost overruns on new hospital. This is by Vanessa Miller. Although University of Iowa Healthcare recently received approval from the Board of Regents to up spending on its new hospital project underway in North Liberty by 33% to $525.6 million, the campus still needs state approval to proceed. 1 year after the State Health Facilities Council, on August 31, 2021, granted UIHC approval to build the 300,000-square-foot hospital portion of a larger 469,000-square-foot project, the Council on August 30 will consider a UIHC request to up that portion's budget from $230 to $307.1 million, or nearly 34%. Should the Council deny its request, UIHC would have to cease working on the project, according to Becky Swift, the state's Certificate of Need Program Manager, but the university could appeal the Council's decision if denied. UIHC says the increased cost is likely due to inflation, higher labor expense, and supply chain issues, not changes in the design. The day after, a UI attorney on July 26th submitted a cost overrun request to the state, UI officials on July 27 sought region approval to increase the total spend on its project, which includes an academic, research, and clinic building that didn't require state approval, from $395 to $525.6 million. When we look at our budget and a change to that, one of the things we do is say, should we stop and wait for the market to change? Kim Hunter, the interim chief executive officer of the University of Iowa Hospitals and Clinics, told the Regents in making that July appeal. So we really considered that, but understand that the impact of delaying our project is significant on patient care. Healthcare access for Iowans would be reduced. Providing complex care to our patients is already strained, and this would further strain that. The 9-member Board of Regents approved the budget increase after asking questions, like why design and management fees are up, what happens if costs rise higher, how the hospital will manage construction change orders, and whether it can minimize costs by placing orders now. In responding to those questions, UI officials committed to keeping spending as low as possible, expressing optimism they would succeed with lower construction bids than their worst-case preparations and potentially be back with another budget revision to bring down the estimated costs. When we realize those bids in roughly a month from now, we'll know where we stand, and that will allow us to assess and come back to the Board of Regents with the results and hopefully a revised downward budget, UI Senior Vice President for Finance and Operations Rod Leonards said at the time. In the state application to up its project spend, submitted before Regents okayed the increase, UIHC officials told the Health Facilities Council they needed Region approval to execute the last few bid packages, which will lock in the guaranteed maximum price associated with the project. UIHC, the University, and the Board of Regents, State of Iowa, have taken steps to be continued good stewards of available construction monies and have participated in the construction manager at-risk contracting model to lock in a guaranteed maximum price on the project, according to UIHC's application. The University is tapping building usage funds, private donations, and debt to cover the costs. Officials confirmed for Regents last month that no state dollars or no tuition will be going to fund this. The construction manager at-risk model insulates the budget from future upward fluctuation once all agreements are signed, according to the university's state application. To date, UIHC has spent $12.4 million on the site and land improvement work and on facilities, according to council documents. In addition to wrapping up planning and design for the entire project, officials report crews have, among other things, graded the site, installed underground utilities, created foundations, and installed underground plumbing and electrical conduits. Additionally, according to UIHC documents, Structural steel has been fabricated, and the contractor is in the process of delivering the material to the site in preparation for erection beginning in the early part of August. Precast panels for the central utility plant have been ordered and are being made, with an expected September delivery. Work still to do includes superstructure, building enclosure, interior finishes, mechanical, electric, technology, pavement, landscaping and medical equipment, and furniture installation. The cost overruns aren't expected to delay completion. Still on track for December 27, 2024, according to UIHC documents. In explaining in more detail reasons for the budget hike, UIHC said, most heating, ventilation, and air conditioning items are made with copper, aluminum, and steel, all of which have experienced significant inflation due to the war in Ukraine. Russia and Ukraine are the number 3 and number 4 global aluminum producers, according to the documents. Global shortages of microchips also is contributing to long production lead times, approaching 1 year, and petroleum price increases greater than 45% affected not only shipping costs, but also petroleum-based components. Electrical components have seen similar increases, as most are made of copper, aluminum, and steel, and major electrical equipment requires microchips. Movable equipment has experienced inflation, supply chain delays, and freight cost increases. And the construction manager at-risk contracts now in place, UIHC can give a more refined number associated with fees and specific contingencies associated with the project. The typically 5-member state council is currently down to 4 members after Jake Porter resigned April 14, having accepted a job in Arkansas. Porter was among the counselors who denied UIHC's first Certificate of Need application for the new North Liberty Hospital in February of 2021. He voted for the project when the council reconsidered its revised application in August. The governor's office is aware of the vacancy, but it has not yet been filled, Swift told the Gazette. Also on the front page today, massive complex eyed for Tiffin. This story by Isabella Zaluska. A massive new family entertainment center, including an IMAX theater, is coming to fast-growing Tiffin. Des Moines-based Fridley Theaters this week announced its newest project, the Palms Theaters IMAX and Family Entertainment Center. It will be part of the Park Place development just off Interstate 380. City Administrator Doug Bolt said the city is excited about the project. He said would be a destination point in the corridor. Whenever you add a quality of life amenity like this to your community, that's great, Bolt said. In addition to the theater and large IMAX screen, the Tiffin complex will feature arcade games, bowling, a restaurant, and bar. The IMAX screen will be 70 feet tall and 90 feet wide, according to a video posted on Facebook by Fridley Theaters. With its long list of amenities, it will be sure to make Tiffin the entertainment hub for the entire I-380 corridor, the movie theater company said in a Facebook post. Fridley Theaters is expected to soon announce more details about the project. I think it shows that Tiffin's moving in the right direction, and to be recognized by entities like this is wonderful, Bolt said. Measured by the percentage rate of growth over the last decade, Tiffin, population 4,512, is the fastest growing city in Iowa, according to the most recent 2020 census. Fridley Theaters opened an IMAX facility in Waukee in 2019. It features 15 auditoriums and a 90-foot wide IMAX screen, the Des Moines Register reported. The movie theater, also called the Palms Theaters and IMAX, has heated seats that can recline. There's also an arcade in addition to a bar and restaurant at the Waukee location. Fridley Theaters has 17 locations in Iowa and one in Nebraska. The city of Tiffin anticipates a significant amount of growth at Park Place. The 265-acre development is being planned by Durs Group of North Liberty. It will include entertainment, restaurants, and shopping, as well as apartments and lots for houses. Park Place expressed excitement for the new addition on Facebook, calling the viewing experience and amenities at Fridley Theaters unlike any other. From the newest and greatest movies, bowling, arcade fun, and dining, Fridley will be a huge hit for the Tiffin community and surrounding corridor, the Facebook post said. Other announced Park Place tenants include Top Tracer Golf Facility, Casa Taquilla, 380 Nails, Farmer State Bank, iGym, and Speedy Mike's Car Wash, according to the Park Place website. Also on the front page, this story is by Vanessa Miller, Kirkwood tuition set to rise 7.5% this fall. Tuition rates for Kirkwood Community College students are expected to be 7.5% above last fall, making the steepest increase this academic year among community colleges in the state, according to college documents. Just over a week before classes are scheduled to resume August 22nd for the fall semester, Kirkwood's Board of Trustees today will consider approving an operating budget for the upcoming year that includes the in-state increase of $14 per semester credit hour, from $186 to $200. Its out-of-state tuition rate per semester credit hour is up $19, from $249 to $268, about 7.6%. Those rates bring the cost of a 3-credit college course at Kirkwood this fall to $600 for in-state students and $804 for out-of-state students. The estimated cost of a full course load of 15 credit hours for an academic year is $6,000 for in-state students and $8,040 for out-of-state students. In-state students at Kirkwood paid $4,860 for a full course load 5 years ago. Kirkwood's rate hike is the steepest among Iowa's 15 community colleges, with Northwest Iowa Community College imposing the second highest dollar increase of $11, amounting to a 5.2% increase, which also comes in as the second biggest percentage jump behind Kirkwood. The substantial increase is due to the high inflationary period that we are in, Kirkwood Chief Financial Officer Jim Choate told the Gazette. But still, looking at tuition alone, Kirkwood's in-state rate ties for third highest in the state, despite the large increase. Because Kirkwood doesn't impose student fees like others, however, its tuition plus fees rank fifth from the lowest. And officials point out Kirkwood's one-year tuition rate hike is below the U.S. inflation rate of 9.06%. Due to the increase, with credit hour enrollment projected to remain stable, Kirkwood expects $3.6 million more in tuition revenue for the 2023 budget year, running through June 30, 2023. Nearly 13,000 students enrolled in Cedar Rapids-based Kirkwood last year. Paired with a $1 million increase in state appropriations and other revenue improvements, including income from the hotel at Kirkwood Center, run as part of the college's hospitality and culinary arts programs, budgeted to return to pre-pandemic levels, Kirkwood expects to bring in $7.4 million more than in fiscal 2022. Its expenses, however, also are projected to be up this year due to wage increases, inflation, and additional supply needs, and travel returning to pre-pandemic levels to facilitate more in-person training, resulting in a $1.7 million deficit. Although Kirkwood this year isn't planning on as much pandemic support from the federal government as it got last year, the college also isn't planning to dole out more than $2 million in bonus payments to workers, like it did in fiscal 2022, to help offset the cost of high inflation, and in particular the rising cost of gas for employees to come to work, according to Choate. Given market forces, Kirkwood's unrestricted cash on hand dropped $5.2 million between June 30 and July 31, bringing it to $42.6 million. It currently has 148 days of cash reserves, down from 166 a month prior, meaning the college has cash reserves to meet our obligations for 4 to 5 months, should we not receive another dollar of cash. Turning now to page 2, on the Iowa Today page, this story by Brittany Miller, CR Council supports Lynn Solar Project. The Cedar Rapids City Council this week unanimously approved a resolution supporting the proposed Duane Arnold Solar Projects in Lynn County that would be, if built, Iowa's largest solar and battery storage facility. The city's seal of approval comes nearly 3 months after the Palos City Council voted unanimously to oppose the county rezoning property within 2 miles of the Palos City limits for the solar projects. The Palos Planning and Zoning Board had recommended the council oppose the projects, which were determined to be within the city's future growth area. If approved, the Duane Arnold Solar Project would be built just north of Palos, near the decommissioned Duane Arnold Energy Center nuclear power plant. Cedar Rapids City documents regarding the resolution stated the projects would directly benefit homeowners and businesses in Cedar Rapids and aid business retention and attraction efforts. The projects also align with the city's Community Climate Action Plan that includes reducing carbon emissions and increasing renewable energy use. Cedar Rapids' resolution, approved on Tuesday, supported the development and construction of NextEra's 2 Duane Arnold solar projects. It also called upon the Lynn County Board of Supervisors to approve the requested renewable overlay district necessary for construction, along with any other approval or action needed to get the project underway. The Lynn County Planning and Zoning Commission recommended on July 28 that county supervisors approve the proposed projects. The supervisors will have 3 considerations of the proposal at the end of August. The proposed installation is split into 2 projects that would use more than 1,100 total acres of land. Duane Arnold Solar 1 includes a 50-megawatt solar facility, while Duane Arnold Solar 2 includes a 150-megawatt solar facility and a 75-megawatt battery storage facility. Florida-based NextEra Energy would develop and build the projects, planning to invest $800 million into them. In November, Alliant Energy filed a proposal to the Iowa Utilities Board to buy and operate the large-scale solar project once it is completed. The utility board is expected to decide on the proposal later this year. If approved, the project would begin operating by the end of 2024. Brittany J. Miller is an environmental reporter for the Gazette and a core member of the Report for America, a national service program that places journalists in local newsrooms to report on undercovered issues. And this story by Gage Miskeman in Iowa Today News, Marion Fire Chief finalists to meet the public on Monday. Residents will have the chance to meet the 4 finalists for Fire Chief Monday evening. The public reception will be from 6 to 7:30 p.m. at City Hall, 1225 6th Avenue. The new chief will succeed Deb Krebel, the now retired chief and a longtime member of the department. When Krebel became chief in 2014, she was one of the first female fire chiefs in the state. The candidates to succeed her and oversee 3 fire stations, including the new headquarters at 100 Irish Drive, are Jason Hansen, Aaron Beamer, Hal Bumgarner, and Tom Fagan. Hansen, Marion's deputy fire chief, is serving as the interim fire chief and has been with the department for 23 years. He obtained his bachelor's degree in fire science from Columbia Southern University in Orange Beach, Alabama, and his associate degree from Kirkwood Community College. Beamer is the deputy chief of operations with the Mason City Fire Department, where he has worked for 22 years. He has a bachelor's degree in fire science administration from Waldorf University in Forest City and an associate degree from Northern Iowa Area Community College in Mason City. Bumgarner, who began his career in 1991 as a firefighter and paramedic, is chief officer for the Pottawatomie County, Kansas Emergency Medical Services. He has a master's degree in security administration from Southwestern College in Kansas, where he also obtained a bachelor's degree in biology. Fagan, with 22 years of experience, is Division Chief of Administration for the Lawrence Douglas, Kansas County Fire Medical Department. He holds a master's degree in management, strategy, and leadership from Michigan State University, a bachelor's degree in human resources from Ottawa University in Ottawa, Kansas, and an associate degree in fire science technology from Blue River Community College in Independence, Missouri. And this final Iowa Today story, UI settles with former track coach, this by Vanessa Miller. The University of Iowa has agreed to pay one of its former track and field coaches $125,000 plus another $15,000 in attorney's fees as part of a settlement agreement that involved his voluntary resignation July 22. Clive Roberts, who had overseen women's sprints and men's and women's horizontal jumps since 2009, also received his full salary and benefits for the duration of his employment, plus payment for accrued but unused vacation time upon separation. He was paid over $90,000 annually. The agreement was not a resignation in lieu of termination agreement to the settlement, which was not an admission of university of or state liability for any wrongful acts or violations of law. As part of the deal, Roberts agreed not to seek work with the UI again or host any camps on the UI campus. He also agreed not to sue the university, state, or Board of Regents. Employee agrees that the consideration stated above is the entirety that will be received for any claims or potential causes of action arising from or relating to employees' employment. That's according to the settlement. During his time at UI Athletics, Roberts led student athletes to 28 Big Ten titles, 48 All-American titles, and 27 school records, according to his bio on the UI Athletics website. Turning now to the Insight page, Resiliency Day brings a storm of emotions. This is by Tamara Marcus. In some ways, it feels like the derecho event of 2020 went as quickly as it came. But we need only look around at our community or speak with our neighbors to know that this disaster is far from being a distant memory. We still find ourselves occasionally surprised by the new views created by the loss of tree canopy, or notice the tarps that hang on housing still in need of repair. But we also take stock of the good that miraculously was brought by this devastating event. People coming together to provide meals, groups completing welfare checks on the most vulnerable, and organizations helping to connect those in need of emergency housing, to name just some of the generous actions we all witnessed and played a part in. It felt like we all got a momentary glimpse of what might be possible if we prioritized the urgent needs of one another. Though we have certainly come a long way, our collective community consciousness still begs for more time to process it all. And as the anniversary of the derecho passes for the second time, I personally find myself reflecting on what I can do to take that resilient spirit of our response to this event and apply it to the day to day. This Resiliency Day brings with it a complex storm of intense emotions. As we continue to take steps to erase the physical impact of the event, planting trees, grinding stumps, fixing homes, etc., I find myself wanting to pause just a little bit on this occasion. I hope we might use this moment in our history to sit with the good and the bad and understand the ways our resiliency might serve as a reminder of the best of who we are individually, what we are capable of collectively, and the world we are able to create when we put these two together. And that's written by Tamara Marcus, who is a social justice and climate action advocate who serves as sustainability director for Linn County. 24-hour Dorman column today is titled, Republicans Take Up Windsurfing. Back when John Kerry was the Democratic presidential nominee in 2004, he was asked by a Virginia voter about his opposition to an $87 billion bill to fund the war in Afghanistan. Kerry said he did vote for an earlier version of the bill. Quote, I actually did vote for the $87 billion before I voted against it, end quote, Kerry said. Republicans pounced and labeled Kerry, who also criticized the Iraq War but voted to authorize it, a flip-flopper. They launched a famous TV ad with footage of Carrie windsurfing off Nantucket, showing Carrie being blown in different directions. "John Kerry, whichever way the wind blows," the ad concluded. It seems some Iowa Republicans in 2022 have taken up windsurfing. Take U.S. Senator Chuck Grassley. Last Sunday, he voted to block adding a provision to the Inflation Reduction Act that would have capped the out-of-pocket cost of insulin to $35 monthly. Because the IRA is a reconciliation spending bill, 60 votes were needed to add the provision. All 50 Democrats and 7 Republicans voted yes, with Grassley and 42 other Republicans voting no, blocking the cap. Grassley swiftly insisted that he supported a far narrower insulin price control measure sponsored by Louisiana Senator John Kennedy. So he was actually for capping insulin prices before he was against it. Kennedy also supported the Democrats' version. So did the American Diabetes Association. Grassley also argued his vote was really a stand against Democrats violating budget rules. He wants to vote on a separate insulin price cap bill. "I'm sure people who can't afford the insulin they need to live will appreciate his commitment to Senate rules and will not at all mind waiting to see if Congress actually acts." Grassley also complained about the Senate debating over the weekend, forcing him to miss a family reunion. In June, U.S. Senator Joni Ernst joined a large Senate majority in voting for legislation, the PACT Act, which would provide health care help to veterans sickened by exposure to burn pits in war zones. But on July 28, when the bill returned to the Senate floor, Ernst joined a group of 25 GOP senators who moved to block the bill, claiming to protest a budget gimmick. Not long before the PACT debate, Democrats announced that they'd reached a deal on the Inflation Reduction Act, paving the way for a key legislative victory. So, gimmick or GOP tantrum? Then, after 4 days of public outrage, Ernst and other Republicans voted in favor of the PACT Act. So Ernst was for it before she was against it before she was for it. U.S. Representatives Ashley Hinson and Marionette Miller-Meeks voted against a bill that would protect Americans' access to a broad array of contraceptive choices. They instead offered a narrow measure directing federal regulators to allow over-the-counter oral contraceptives for adults. So they actually favored one kind of contraceptive before being against many. Hinson voted against the bipartisan infrastructure bill last fall, calling it spending at its worst, but spent considerable time touting projects funded by the bill. She was against the bill before she supported the spending. Iowa Republicans, whichever way the wind blows, and that's 24-hour Dorman. One community letter today is titled, "Wake Up and Do Your Part." Wake up and smell the coffee. How many times have we heard this phrase in reference to someone needing to get honest with themselves, to face reality or pay attention to what's going on around them? Across this great country, and in fact across Iowa, more and more of us are waking up. Let's face it, the American people are smart, and be it Democrat or Republican, you don't have to look too far to realize that this country is in trouble. We have a border crisis, unemployment, the cost of gas is through the roof, and the current administration would rather change the definition of recession than deal with the fact that we are in one. What does that have to do with you and me? Everything. You see, it's time that we take note of how far we have fallen and then wake up and get involved in making a difference in our local school boards, our cities, our county, and our state. As our schools go, so go the cities, and as the city goes, so go the counties, the states, and the nation. It all starts with you and me. If you're awake, find a local candidate and volunteer your time by making phone calls or helping with literature drops, door knocking, delivering signs, walking in parades, or whatever else needs done. Do your part. Make a difference. And that's signed today by Mark Consett from Cedar Rapids. You are listening to the reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette for today, Thursday, August 11, on IRIS. And now we turn to today's obituaries, first in the other or short notices, from Cedar Rapids. Rao C. Zems, Jr., age 86, died Tuesday, August 9. Cedar Memorial Funeral Home is in charge of arrangements. From Ely, Bernadine, known as Bim Rahans, age 95, died Wednesday, August 10. Brosh Chapel and the Abba Center, Cedar Rapids. And from Hazleton, William S. Quario, 72, died Wednesday, August 20th. Jameson Schmidt's funeral home in Olwine is in charge of arrangements. In Cedar Rapids, Dr. Ernest C. Primer, Jr. passed away Wednesday, August 3, at Sherman House Hospice in Phoenix, Arizona. A celebration of life will be planned at a later date. In Hills, Mary Louise Walsh Hurt of Hills, formerly of Iowa City, died Monday, August 8th at Atrium Village in Hills. Mass of Christian burial will be celebrated at 10 a.m. Monday, August 15th at St. Wenceslaus Catholic Church in Iowa City. Visitation will be Sunday, August 14th from 4 to 6 p.m. at Lensing Funeral and Cremation Service. Burial will be at St. Joseph Cemetery in Iowa City. Lensing Funeral Home is in charge of arrangements. In Iowa City, Lauren James Hemingway of Iowa City passed away Tuesday, August 9th at the age of 30 from complications of Fanconi anemia, or FA. Lauren had a wide range of interests, was happy outside roughing it or in a high-end restaurant enjoying fancy food. He will be remembered for his quick wit. A celebration of Lauren's life will be held Saturday, August 13th at West Branch Friends Church at 11 a.m. with a visitation beginning at 10 a.m. Friends and family are invited to his family farm located at 5544 280th Street Northeast, Iowa City, on Saturday after 5 p.m. for fellowship, memory sharing, and a bonfire at dusk. Please bring a lawn chair. All are welcome to attend. The Henderson Barker Funeral Home in West Branch is caring for Lauren's family. Online condolences may be made to the family at hendersonbarkerfuneralhome.com. Memorials are suggested to Fanconi Anemia Research Fund in his honor. From Cedar Rapids, Cheryl Lynn Abram, age 61, passed away at home from her battle with cancer, surrounded by her children, Tuesday, April 5. A memorial service will be held at 11 a.m. Saturday, August 20, at the Salvation Army Corps, with a light lunch to follow. In Marion, Daniel Han Lewis, age 38, died from a motorcycle accident in Cedar Rapids on July 27. A private family gathering will be held in honor of Daniel's life on earth. In Pawsatuck, Connecticut, Robert Stanley Miskeman passed away Friday, July 29th at the age of 79. A service will be held Monday, August 22nd at 11 a.m. at Woyaz and Son Funeral Home. That's in Montville, Connecticut. There will be a lunch after service. In lieu of flowers, the family asks those who wish to donate to the American Heart Association, the American Legion, or Wounded Warriors in his name. Online condolences for Robert may be shared at woyazandson.com. From Hiawatha, Curtis Allen Brown, age 74, passed away Tuesday, August 9th at the Oldorf Hospice House of Mercy in Hiawatha. Visitation is from 9 to 11 a.m. Saturday, August 13th at Cedar Memorial Chapel Stateroom. Memorial service is at 11 a.m. Saturday, August 13th at Cedar Memorial Chapel of Memories. Online condolences are welcome at cedarmemorial.com. Turning now to the sports page, in Prep Sports, this story by K.J. Pilcher, 2022 Boys Golf Preview, Prairie Ready for Some Hardware. Consider it a barometer for the upcoming year. The Rotary Pribble Junior Golf Classic serves as a good gauge for Cedar Rapids Prairie's varsity golf season. The Hawks swept the open and novice divisions, including two of the top three, another in seventh, and five in the top 20. The way we played, that gives us a lot of momentum into the season, said Peyton Burns, a Prairie senior who won Preble's Open Division. I think we played pretty well, and we've put in the work. A lot of guys have been playing in tournaments all summer. Prairie is in the midst of an unprecedented run for the program, reaching the Class 4A state tournament the last two seasons. The Hawks return everyone from last year's team and start their trek for a third straight state berth as competition begins with the Mississippi Valley Conference Super Meet today at Hunter's Ridge Golf Course. The focus is to continue the steady climb in success the last two seasons. It's business as usual, Prairie coach Eric Columbus said. We've gotten used to playing well. We want to carry that over this year. We're looking to be dialed in. In Boys Golf 2022, here are the players and teams to watch. From Cedar Rapids, Xavier Charlie Allen, a senior, two-time state participant, two-time first-team All-Mississippi Valley Conference Valley Division, and 2020 Valley Player of the Year. From Cedar Rapids, Washington, Ben Blockinger, a senior, first-team All-MVC Mississippi, recorded 39.17 combined adjusted average, shot 38.2 per 9 holes and 78.5 per 18 holes. From Cedar Rapids Prairie, Peyton Burns, a senior, tied for 11th at the 2021 Class 4A state meet. Two-time All-MVC Mississippi 2022 Rotary Preble champion, and an average of 35.6 and 76.6. From Cedar Rapids Kennedy, Reed Hall, Jr., two-time state participant, tying for 11th in 2021. From Cedar Rapids Xavier, Quincy Johnson, a junior, a 2020 state participant, two-time All-MVC Valley Division player. From Cedar Rapids Jefferson, Logan Miller, a senior, MVC Valley Division medalist, and two-time All-MVC Valley. From Linmar, Caden Postma, a senior, a two-time state participant, tying for 21st in 2021. From Cedar Rapids Prairie, Tanner Wachtel, Jr., a two-time state participant, a second-team All-MVC Mississippi. And from Western Dubuque, a sophomore, Brock Wilson, the 2021 4A state qualifier. Teams to watch are Cedar Rapids Jefferson, Cedar Rapids Kennedy, Cedar Rapids Prairie, and Cedar Rapids Xavier. And in events of area interest today, Jefferson, Kennedy, Washington Prairie, Xavier, Linmar, City High, Liberty, and Iowa City West are at the Mississippi Valley Conference Super Meet at the Linmar Golf Course, and that starts at 9:30 a.m. And tonight is the second major league baseball game held at the Field of Dreams Stadium in Dyersville. The Chicago Cubs play the Cincinnati Reds. That game is at 6:15 today on KFXA. Turning to the hoopla section in the food category, this story is by Elijah Desius. Smooth Operators is the title of the article. A new health-focused cafe is finding common ground between very different target audiences in a post-pandemic world. While traditional restaurants and food-oriented businesses are struggling with inflation, overhead costs, and unprecedented supply chain interruptions, the owners of Nutrisport and Smoothie think their new venture is a proven concept for the post-pandemic world. With low overhead, the fast casual concept has a wide variety of smoothies, wraps, and breakfast bowls that serve two crowds, business professionals during the lunch hour and gym goers coming from their workout. With multiple gyms in the downtown area and some downtown business workers returning to the office for work, the timing was right for Cedar Rapids owners Craig Coder and Brent Stepanek to open up the concept. Briefly, if you go, it's called Nutrisport and Smoothie at 223 2nd Street Southeast in Cedar Rapids. Their hours are 6:30 a.m. to 7 p.m. Monday to Friday, 8 a.m. to 2 p.m. Saturday, and 9 a.m. to 3 p.m. on Sunday. The phone number there is 319-200-5558. Find a variety of fruit and protein smoothies, wraps, and breakfast bowls with a robust list of optional supplements to add to your drinks. They are open for dine-in, carry-out, and DoorDash delivery. Plans are back on for the new Raising Cane's Chicken Fingers location in Cedar Rapids. A representative for the Chicken Fingers chain, which opened a Coralville location in April, said that construction work has started. The site at 230 Collins Road Northeast was approved for a new building permit by the City of Cedar Rapids on July 20th. Raising Cane's has slated this second corridor location for a late December opening. The address is the same one where Raising Cane's previously planned to open in the fall of 2021. As the Coralville location made more noticeable progress, a Raising Cane's representative told the Gazette in November of 2021 that the chain would be looking for a new site in Cedar Rapids due to some changes. The new location will be company-owned. Previously, reporting indicated that the new location would be owned by a Nebraska-based franchise. Iowa City's first plant bar is opening soon. Iowa City's first plant bar is putting its roots down at the former space of Van B's Brew. The new plant bar, which appears to be only the second one in Iowa, after Pots and Shots opened in West Des Moines, plans to open at the end of August at 505 East Washington Street. The space will feature lush greens ushering in a relaxing aura, complemented by Iowa beers, kombucha, ciders, plant-themed cocktails, and non-alcoholic beverages, like herbaceous or fruity slushies. Owner Emily Samuelson has been working the past few months to renovate the space, which has been vacant since November of 2020. With 25 years of experience in the hospitality industry as a bartender, server, barista, and more, the new plant bar is Samuelson's first time owning a business. You may recognize her from Film Scene, where she helped get that off the ground in 2013. The plant bar, featuring ample patio space and large windows, will offer a cafe-like environment with both daytime and evening hours. I wanted a place where you could have a cafe experience, but get a glass of wine or a cocktail. People are craving that reintroduction into the community and having a fun, comfortable place to be, Samuelson said. And I love plants. They create oxygen. They're very calming. And the new Tower Cafe opened August 5 at the ground floor of Alliant Tower, less than 2 months after Fresh Deli and Grill closed. The new cafe at 200 First Street Southeast in Cedar Rapids, owned by Andy Dutmeyer and Vic Cooper, will be open weekdays from 7:30 a.m. to 2 p.m. The menu offers wraps, sandwiches, burgers, tacos, salads, and coffee from Dash Roasters. Fresh Deli and Grill closed June 30 after a 7-year business location. Owners Salem and Marbette Dowd did not explain why they closed. And Mickey's Irish Pub and Grill, a staple in downtown Iowa City, is planning a second location. On August 2, the pub announced on social media that it plans to open at 720 Pasha Parkway, Unit 8 in North Liberty. Hiring is underway for full-time and part-time employees to staff the new site. That location in the strip mall was home to Rocky O'Brien's Public House. That closed on June 26th. Turning to the Business 380 page, this story, Area Substance Abuse Council names director. The Area Substance Abuse Council Board of Directors named Stephanie Bosenberg as the not-for-profit's executive director. Bosenberg has worked at ASAC for more than 25 years, previously having been the agency's Health Information Systems director. She also has served on its senior leadership team that guides the agency's policies and procedures. She succeeds Jeanette Archer-Simmons, who was named executive director in August of 2019 and whose last day there was June 17th. Cedar Rapids-based ASAC provides substance abuse and gambling disorder prevention, treatment, and recovery service programs in Lynn, Jackson, Jones, Clinton, Benton, Delaware, and Dubuque counties. It is part of the Iowa Department Public Health Integrated Provider Network. Also on the Business 380, Green State Credit Union starts group to aid charities. North Liberty-based Green State Credit Union, Iowa's largest credit union, has started Green State Foundation. The credit union, in a news release, said the 501c3 foundation's goal is to support charities that share the same values and whose missions align. The foundation at least once a year will offer members the opportunity to vote on where some of our grants will go. Tara Wackendorf, the foundation's president, told the Gazette in an email on Wednesday. This will be conducted via a survey, and we will select the top recipients to send $1,000 to. This will be a fluid benefit, as each year it could change with the amount we give or the focus. At this time, members cannot choose a charity when they join, Wackendorf said, adding that policy could change as the program matures. For now, as a brand new entity, we are taking baby steps as we get our feet wet in this new world of foundation giving, she said. We are just really excited about the additional impact we can provide in the markets we serve. The foundation also offers a suite of financial tools called Money Right for its members, according to the release. More details can be found at greenstatefoundation.org. And this story on the Business 380 page, lower prices offer slight reprieve from inflation. Falling prices for gas, airline tickets, and clothes gave Americans a little bit of relief last month, though overall inflation still is running at close to its highest level in four decades. Consumer prices climbed 8.5% in July compared with a year earlier, the government said Wednesday. That's down from 9.1% year-over-year increase in June. On a monthly basis, prices were unchanged from June to July, the first time that's happened after 25 months of increases. But the reprieve offered no certainty that prices would stay on the decline. Inflation has slowed in the recent past only to re-accelerate in subsequent months. And even if price increases continue to weaken, they are a long way from the Federal Reserve's 2% annual target. There's good reason to think inflation will continue to slow, said Michael Pugliese, a Wells Fargo economist. What I think gets lost in that discussion is slow by how much. Even if it were to fall to 4%, less than half of its current level, Pugliese suggested the Fed would need to keep raising interest rates or at least keep them high. Much of the relief last month was felt by travelers. Hotel room costs fell 2.7% from June to July. Airfare nearly 8%, and rental car prices dropped a whopping 9.5%. Those price drops followed steep increases in the past year after COVID-19 cases eased and travel rebounded. Airfares still are nearly 30% higher than they were a year ago. Gas price dropped from $5 a gallon on average in mid-June to $4.20 by the end of last month, and were just $4.01 on Wednesday, according to AAA. Oil prices also have fallen, and cheaper gas likely will pull down inflation this month as well, economists said. Last month's declines in travel-related prices helped to lower the core inflation, a measure that includes the volatile food and energy categories and provides a clearer picture of underlying price trends. Core prices rose only 0.3% from June, the smallest month-to-month increase since March. Compared with a year ago, core inflation amounted to 5.9% in July, the same year-over-year increase as in June. Americans still are absorbing bigger price increases than they have in decades. Grocery prices jumped 1.1% in July and are 13% higher than a year ago, the largest year-over-year increase since 1979. There's good reason to think inflation will continue to slow. What I think gets lost is slow by how much. Returning to one Iowa Today story, this by Gage Miskeman, Hiawatha manager joins Team Marion. Hiawatha's longtime city manager Kim Downs has announced she will be joining the city of Marion as deputy city manager in September. Downs, who's held the Hiawatha post since 2013, will join Marion City Manager Wyon Waller's Team Marion on September 6. The Marion City Council must approve Downs' contract at its next meeting with a salary of $162,100 proposed. I am excited for the opportunity to continue to play another role in a metro community I have grown to love, Downs said. Over the years, I have worked closely with Marion and have always been impressed with the drive to enhance the community through partnership and innovation. Downs has 22 years of local government experience. In her current role as Hiawatha City Manager, she oversees the daily operations of all city departments, including budget development, capital improvement plans, and economic development. She was named Iowa City Manager of the Year in 2020. She obtained her bachelor's degree in interdisciplinary administration from Mount Mercy University in 2008, and in 2016 earned a master's degree in business administration from the University of Dubuque. In 2013, she became Hiawatha's city manager, the first woman to hold that job in the city. Downs led the city of about 7,500 through the 2020 derecho and has championed the metro-wide Tower Terrace Road project, now under construction with a new interchange planned at Interstate 380. Her departure comes at a time of growth for the city, which recently added a new plaza at City Hall, is planning for a second fire station, and seeing residential and commercial investment along Tower Terrace Road. The Hiawatha City Council is set to meet next Wednesday and decide on an interim city manager and next steps. Kim Downs has unmatched energy, and she leaves behind big shoes to fill, Hiawatha Mayor Bill Bennett said. She has been a great asset for Hiawatha, and we wish her and her family the best. Marion City Manager Waller said Downs is a highly collaborative and well-respected leader in the region. We are thrilled to have her join Team Marion and help take our organization and this community to the next level. Deputy City Manager's position has been vacant since 2019 when the city filled other positions linked to the pandemic and derecho recovery. Kirsten Fisher, Marion's Director of Human Resources, said 72 people applied for the Deputy City Manager position. Finishing up with some weather info, scattered showers are possible this afternoon. Cedar Rapids looking for a high of 78 and Iowa City a high of 80. Lows are in the low 60s. Scattered showers possible again tomorrow and a chance of storms developing on Saturday. Again, high tomorrow of 75 in Cedar Rapids, 77 in Iowa City. Normally, the high for today is 82 and the low is 61. We set a record high of 100 degrees in 1941 and a record low of 47 in 2004. We're in the full moon phase with moon rise at 8:34 p.m., moon set at 6:34 a.m. Sunset tonight at 8:13 p.m., sunrise tomorrow at 6:11 a.m. That gives us 14 hours and 3 minutes of daylight. That does it for the reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette on IRIS for today, Thursday, August 11. I've been your reader, Kathleen. You can access a copy of today's reading online at iowaradioreading.org. Thank you for listening and have a great, safe day.
From the Bureau of Economic Geology, this is Earth Date. Shortly after modern humans arrived in Europe, the Neanderthals disappeared, and scientists think we had something to do with it. Neanderthals, or their direct ancestors, migrated out of Africa and into the Middle East and Europe around 250,000 years ago. Soon, they were well adapted to the environment. Large eyes helped them see in the longer nights and darker winters. Stout bodies helped them retain heat and handle large prey, and provided space for the large liver and kidneys needed for a diet heavy in protein. Their brains were as big as ours, but spent processing power on their greater visual and motor abilities. This may not have allowed them to develop higher communication or conceptual thinking to match ours, which may have been their downfall. Modern humans arrived on the scene 45,000 years ago, less physically adapted, but more mentally adaptable. We had cooperative hunting methods superior to the Neanderthals, allowing us to outcompete them for food, and perhaps reducing the large herbivore populations that they depended on. We also had superior tools and weapons. When there were conflicts between the groups, as there have been among tribes throughout history, our superior technology probably allowed us to prevail. But we weren't only fighting. There must have been considerable interbreeding, since we can find 1-3% of the Neanderthal genome in modern man. Which means the Neanderthals never completely disappeared. A little bit of them is alive in us today. I'm Scott Tinker.
Earth Date is produced by the Bureau of Economic Geology at the University of Texas at Austin, with support from Schlumberger, helping oil and gas companies increase production and efficiency while lowering environmental impact. You can hear more Earth Date stories at earthdate.org.